From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. At the U.S. Supreme Court today, the justices turned their attention to sports, specifically to the NFL and its exclusive deal with Reebok to sell billions of dollars worth of hats, shirts, and other apparel. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
It used to be that lots of different companies had NFL licenses to sell stuff with NFL team logos. But in 2001, the NFL decided to award its merchandising license for all 32 teams to just one company, Reebok. Among those frozen out was American Needle, a family-owned company that until 2001 specialized in manufacturing NFL team caps. Indeed, the caps were one quarter of its business. The company challenged the exclusive licensing deal in court, claiming it amounted to a conspiracy among the teams to fix prices, and noting that cap prices had gone way up since the deal. But a federal appeals court ruled that the league is a single entity that operates as one business, not 32 competing businesses, and it tossed the case out of court without a trial. Antitrust experts saw the decision as an opportunity for the NFL and other leagues to gain immunity from lawsuits over more than just merchandising agreements. They saw the ruling as a vehicle to allow sports leagues to potentially, at least, set prices for tickets or parking at games or fees for fantasy football, for instance. Today in the Supreme Court, American Needle's lawyer Glenn Nager told the justices that the NFL should not be able to circumvent the nation's antitrust laws that way. He said the NFL teams are separately owned and operated businesses, and that by construing the league as a single entity, the lower court had approved a merchandising monopoly for the NFL. Several justices asked where to draw the line. After all, you need agreement on league rules and a schedule. Justice Breyer, noting that he knows baseball better than football, questioned the premise of apparel competition. You want the Red Sox to compete in selling T-shirts with the Yankees? I don't know a Red Sox fan who would take a Yankees sweatshirt if you gave it away. Justice Stevens suggested that the real competition for apparel is between sports, football and basketball, for instance, not between teams. But the questioning got even more intense when the NFL's lawyer, Greg Levy, rose to argue. He conceded that the teams used to individually license their own logos, but he maintained that the purpose of the NFL exclusive deal with Reebok was not to make money, but to promote the game of football. Justice Scalia, they don't care whether the sale of T-shirts promotes the game. They sell it to make money. Justice Sotomayor observed that if the aim is to make money, and she said she could well see that argument, then a league agreement to fix prices would be a violation of the antitrust laws. Sotomayor prodded further. What decision could sports teams make that would be subject to antitrust scrutiny? Answer, the NFL clubs are not separate sources of independent power. They're a unit, a single entity. Justice Sotomayor, so you're seeking through this ruling what you haven't gotten from Congress, an absolute bar to an antitrust claim. Justice Breyer analogized the situation this way. A joint venture to play football is one thing. A joint NFL venture to build houses is another. Chief Justice Roberts, and the other side says selling logos is closer to selling houses than it is to playing football. So if there's a factual dispute about whether a particular activity of the league is designed to promote the game or is designed simply to make money, then that's the sort of thing that should go to a trial. Justice Scalia, you say that the trademarks have no value apart from the game? I guess you could say the same thing for each of the 32 franchises. They're worthless if the NFL disappears. So does that mean they can agree to fix the price at which their franchises would be sold? Lawyer Levy didn't directly answer that question, but contended that the NFL is much like a law firm that sets the prices charged by its lawyers. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The American Red Cross says it has run out of medical supplies in Haiti. A spokesman insists more will be sent, but it's not clear how soon. Meanwhile, other medical groups with people on the ground in Haiti paint a picture of unlimited need and almost no capacity to meet it. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
Doctors Without Borders has a lot of people in Haiti, around 800. What it doesn't have anymore are its three hospitals that were well-known destinations for Haiti's poor. Those hospitals are now wreckage, or too unstable to use. Paul McFunn, the group's coordinator for Haiti, says some of his staff are unaccounted for, too. The remainder are overwhelmed by patients wandering the streets, traumatized and desperate for care.
The reality of what we're seeing is severe traumas, head wounds, crushed limbs, severe problems that cannot be dealt with the level of medical care that we currently have available with no infrastructure really to support it.
There's virtually no way to do surgery, for instance, so there's no way to set broken bones that have pierced the skin.
The best we can offer them at the moment is first aid care and stabilization.
McFunn, talking from Toronto, says Doctors Without Borders staffers are besieged by people they cannot help.
Everywhere we go, a massive demand from people to help them with trapped family members, with people who are suffering from major injuries. You know, you're on the streets, you're getting mobbed, particularly because we're identified with that kind of medical care.
Dr. John Pa paints a similar picture. He's a Haitian on the faculty of the Cornell Weill Medical College in New York City, who runs an HIV hospital and clinic in Port-au-Prince. Phone lines aren't working, but Dr. Pop writes in an email that he was in a meeting with Haiti's prime minister and health minister yesterday evening when parts of the concrete ceiling started falling down. "We all got out alive by chance," Pop says. He estimates that 75% of Port-au-Prince is rubble, including parts of his own hospital. Clearing the rubble to reach those underneath is the number one priority, he says, followed by medical supplies, water, food, and, of course, shelter. But several hours away on Haiti's central plateau, there are well-equipped and expertly staffed hospitals that were untouched by the quake. But the power is out, says Andrew Marks of the Boston-based group Partners in Health.
The hospital in Conge may have 2 days' worth of diesel to keep the generators going. The central power is out, so, you know, in 2 days the lights go out.
And the operating rooms go dark. Marks hopes the group can scrounge the diesel fuel to keep the operating rooms functioning. Meanwhile, some of the 4,000 Partners in Health medical staff have gone down to Port-au-Prince to triage the injured. Marks hopes to find a way to bring the most severely wounded up to the functioning hospitals by helicopter if he can find one. But there's not much time to organize all this, says Dr. Sten Vermund, an international health expert at Vanderbilt University.
Well, it's got to be today. We've got to get people in. You hear of people surviving under rubble for 3, 4, 5 days, but those are an increasing minority.
Vermont sees this particular crisis as something different from, say, the tsunami in far-off Indonesia.
This is right on our doorstep. It is a stone's throw from where we are. This is the time for our government to show its leadership and do the right thing.
What happens next, he says, will be a defining moment in the history of medical and humanitarian aid. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Google always has the attention of the tech industry, but today it really turned heads. The company announced that it might pull out of China.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. This past year was a grim one for the magazine industry. Advertising revenue plummeted, and major publications, including Gourmet and Modern Bride, shut down for good. Other magazines, like Fortune, scaled back the number of issues they put out. But even in this tough climate, new magazines are still coming out. NPR's Jim Zaroli looks at what magazine publishers are doing to stay relevant in the digital age.
Many people are pessimistic about magazines these days. Not Carly Roney. She co-founded a company called The Knot that publishes bridal magazines. This morning, she's brimming over with enthusiasm as she addresses her sales staff.
But we have been on an absolute roll, I think, on the editorial side. I mean, I feel like we are working like a crazy machine at this point.
The Knot is part of a new generation of companies trying to take advantage of a rapidly shifting media landscape. The University of Mississippi's Samir Husni, who writes a blog called Mr. Magazine, says people still read magazines, but advertisers are deserting them for the internet. And the problem's gotten a lot worse since the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the meltdown in the financial markets.
They have a serious problem with the advertising because the entire business model died. I mean, the American business model died in September 2008.
Big magazine companies are desperately looking for ways to survive, says consultant Martin Walker.
All of the smart publishing companies, not only are they into the internet and into digital magazines, but they have TV deals, book deals, they're into video, they're into television.
A lot of existing magazines have tried to accommodate themselves to the digital age with Twitter feeds, Facebook pages, and iPhone apps. Esquire recently had an augmented reality issue, hold up the cover of the magazine to a webcam, and an image of Robert Downey Jr. pops up on your computer screen.
Ah! Booyah! In your face!
And bless your soul. Welcome to the augmented reality issue of Esquire magazine. My name is Robert Downey Jr.
These efforts have had mixed success. But despite the industry's troubles, a lot of publishers aren't ready to give up on magazines. Samir Hosni says more than 600 new titles came out in 2009, though many were one-time-only publications. Some of the more successful launches use brand names from television, like the Food Network magazine. Others, like The Knot, started out on the Internet. It was founded as a bridal website, and it still makes money through web ads and e-commerce. It sells wedding merchandise, and it runs a gift registry linked to major retailers like Macy's. Carly Roney says the company has amassed a huge database of new brides, and this gives the company a pipeline into what its audience is thinking.
So we have a variety of different revenue streams, so we don't have to rely on just one. And it's really proven to be successful for us because we're focused on the consumer.
And in recent years, the company has also put a lot of its energy into magazines. It publishes 17 regional bridal magazines and spin-offs for pregnant women and new homeowners. Roney says magazines do something for their audience that other media don't.
Magazines provide you a sort of realm of discovery, I think, that looking on the web, you're searching for information and you might find some, but when you're browsing through a magazine, it's just a much more, I don't know, it's a sort of a relaxing and just entirely different experience. And so we've always felt that, particularly in the world of weddings, where brides are hungry for pictures and inspiration and ideas, there will always be bridal magazines.
Still, The Knot has to cut corners in a way that its wealthier uptown rivals never did during their heyday. It's published in a downtown Manhattan building where the heat is uneven and the wooden floors creak underfoot. The same staff members write content for both the magazines and the web. It's a long way from The Devil Wears Prada. Samir Hosni says the economic fundamentals of the magazine world have changed for good, and too many publishers are in denial about it.
They still believe that it's just a cycle, that advertising will come back and things will go back to the way it used to be. I think they are in a coma. If they think that things are going to go back to the way they used to be before 2007, they are not living in this world.
Those companies that are to survive, he says, will have to do what The Knot is doing, figure out how to reinvent their business model and find ways to make money off the many people who still want to read traditional magazines. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
The Haiti quake may have come as a shock to the millions of people who are now suffering through its aftermath, but it was not a complete surprise to geologists. Though large quakes in Haiti are rare, the country sits in the middle of an active seismic zone. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
If you live in California, you're used to occasional earthquakes reminding you that the big one could come at any time. The Caribbean is considerably quieter than that, but Carol Prentice at the U.S. Geological Survey says don't be fooled.
Well, it definitely is earthquake country. This is a plate boundary between the North American plate and the Caribbean plate.
The Earth's tectonic plates are forever in motion, and in this case, the Caribbean plate is gradually moving east in relation to the North American plate. The movement may seem slow, about an inch a year, but the edges of those plates are locked together, so they don't move all the time. Instead, stress builds up in fault zones, and one of those runs very close to Port-au-Prince.
You can see it on Google Earth. It's not that hard to see. It has a very clear signature through the landscape in the area.
So lots of stress, a big fault. To Prentice, the implications are obvious.
It's not a surprise to have a big earthquake along this fault.
What was a surprise, as is almost always the case with earthquakes, is the timing. Jeff Abers is at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory.
This is a fault segment that has been really quiet for about the last 200 years. There's one earthquake in the 1860s, but most of the larger known earthquakes were back in the 1700s.
So when the rock in the fault finally gave way and let off the strain that had been accumulating for more than a century, the resulting earthquake was very powerful. The ground shook for tens of seconds, and the fault gave way over a stretch that's currently estimated around 30 to 60 miles. Abers notes that the epicenter was not only very close to Port-au-Prince, the quake started at a fairly shallow depth, just 6 miles below the surface.
By being shallow and on land, the strongest shaking winds up being fairly close to population centers here.
The quake had a preliminary magnitude of 7.0, and since then there have been more than a dozen strong aftershocks above magnitude 5.
One of the concerns right now is there's a lot of structures that were badly damaged in the main shock, and they're now being exposed to these late aftershocks, some of which are quite significant.
The quake toppled many buildings that were not constructed to withstand such violent shaking. That includes buildings of brick and concrete that were not adequately reinforced with steel bars. Abers says there's also a lot of construction on Port-au-Prince's steep hillsides.
These unstable slopes tend to fail in strong shaking, and that's often where a lot of the damage could happen.
Early reports do suggest that buildings tumbled down slopes and that landslides contributed to the death and destruction. For the moment, all eyes are on the human tragedy in Haiti, the deaths, injuries, trapped people, and devastation in one of the poorest countries in the world. And Carol Prentice from the U.S. Geological Survey knows this will not be the last major quake to hit the region. She's been studying a fault that runs just to the north of Haiti and cuts through the Dominican Republic.
That fault, where we studied it, has not had a big earthquake for about 800 years, and it is certainly due for a large earthquake as well.
She says the local governments are aware of that hazard, but she doesn't know how well prepared they would be to deal with it. Richard Harris, NPR News.